It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to Wisconsin's Attorney General about this Saturday's statewide Drug Take-Back Day.
First, after an extended legal battle, a federal judge ruled this week that the Lake Superior Chippewa Indians will be able to hunt deer at night in parts of northern Wisconsin known as the Ceded Territory.
Starting November 1st, a night hunting season will begin in the area, despite concerns from the Department of Natural Resources. The agency has opposed the night hunt, citing concerns over public safety.
Paul Smith is with us now. He covers outdoors and conservation issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, 24 years ago, U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb said no to night hunting for the Chippewa tribes, and now the same Barbara Crabb has reversed that decision and said that the hunt can proceed. What changed?
Well, I think a few things changed in that time frame. The tribes put together a comprehensive and quite convincing plan to hold these night hunts for deer. They have a tribal code that spells out the way that these hunts would be held. They didn't have that when Barbara Crabb first reviewed this. From a public safety standpoint, it addresses virtually any concern that could be had. We have a couple of other types of hunting that occur in Wisconsin, for instance, at night, and it's allowed to licensed hunters. And what the tribe has laid out in their night hunting plan goes above and beyond things that are done for that other public hunting. The other thing that's important to note is the state in 2012 passed a wolf hunting and trapping law. And when the legislature passed that, it included the ability to hunt wolves at night. So even though Barbara Crabb initially had turned down this part of the tribe's rights, when this law was passed in 2012 for wolf hunting at night, the tribes seized that opportunity and renewed their push for this nighttime deer hunting.
Right, and you say those two things, the Wolf Management Act and this night hunting decision, you say those two things are directly linked. Can you spell that out a little bit more?
The tribes wanted to have nighttime deer hunting. It's in their rights as part of these treaties that date to the 1800s. And they were able to get many of the rights and exercise them, but this was one thing that was hanging out there. And so when the state passed the wolf hunting and trapping law, that just on the face of that, that was the tribes were against the hunting of wolves in any sense. As part of their creation story, the tribes see the wolf as a brother, as a clan member, and many tribal members appeared at hearings when the state was considering this wolf hunting and trapping season and opposed it. So that certainly didn't sit well with the tribes that the state very quickly passed this ability to hunt and trap wolves. And then when it included this provision to hunt the wolves at night, and they had been denied the right to hunt deer at night, there's a direct link there. Later that year, so it was 2012, early in the year when the wolf hunting and trapping law was passed, and so it only took a couple of months before the tribe started to pursue this nighttime deer hunting again, and it took a couple of twists and turns, including through an appeals court last year in October in Chicago, that sent it back to Barbara Crabb. But on Tuesday, she ruled that there was no reason for the tribes not to hunt deer at night.
And before we go any deeper into this, David, let's talk about what this deer hunting will look like. I'm sorry, Paul. What would this look like? How would it work?
The way the tribes have laid out the plan is they would the participants would be required to take an advanced hunter training course. They'd also have to pass a firearm proficiency test to show that they can accurately shoot the firearm they intend to use. They would need to file a plan on the site that they want to hunt at. And they would also need to only shoot in one direction. And the site would have to have what's called an adequate backstop. It could be as simple as shooting from an elevated platform towards the earth. But those are some of the parts of the plan. And as a practical matter, they would probably go out. This hasn't been done in the state, so we're using a little conjecture here. But probably go out after dark to this site and be armed with a firearm and a spotlight. And they may have baited the site with some food that the deer would come into, and then turn the light on and shoot the animal. So that's probably the way it would proceed. This is a means of killing deer. This is it's not sport. It's and the tribes have framed it as a means of subsistence, of providing food for their tribal members.
We're talking to Paul Smith right now with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about a federal judge's recent decision to allow the state's Chippewa tribes to hunt deer at night in the state's ceded territory. This is about the northern third of Wisconsin. And, Paul, the DNR has been pretty adamantly opposed to this over the years. What have their main objections been?
The DNR has been opposed, and the main objection has been public safety. They're concerned with the use of firearms at night and potential for someone to be injured. And that's been the main grounds that they've opposed it on. However, they also know that this will be unpopular with a large portion of the hunting community in Wisconsin, the general public, similar to when walleye spearing started. In the 1980s, it will likely result in quite a lot of controversy and criticism. So I think the department wanted to prevent night deer hunting by the tribes to just sort of avoid this type of controversy.
Now, you've said that this is about subsistence, according to the tribes. We also say it's a pressure point between the tribes and the state. Where is that relationship right now? We talked a little bit about that wolf management history, but how will this affect the relationship between the state and the Chippewa tribes?
The tribes see this as a victory, certainly, and it's a substantial one. They have experienced a relationship with the state that's certainly gone through different phases. And it, from my perspective, is generally contentious. And a couple of items in the recent years that have worsened the relationship with the legislature's passage of the mining bill, which made it easier for a company to site a mine very close to the Bad River tribe risks for that watershed, and the tribes were strongly against changing the state's mining law, and then the wolf hunting and trapping law. So for them to pursue this nighttime deer hunting opportunity and get this right affirmed, or be able to practice this right, I think is from their perspective, quite a strong victory, and it may be more of a bargaining chip for them in future negotiations for matters than it is a means of actually obtaining protein for their families. I'm sure the tribal members will exercise the right and achieve some benefit from that, but I think that in the broader scheme of things, this type of a legal victory is more important to them from the perspective of negotiating with the state.
Paul, thanks a lot for talking today.
Yep, thank you very much.
That was Outdoors editor Paul Smith with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about a federal judge's decision to allow the state's Chippewa tribes to hunt deer at night in the state's ceded territory.
Coming up next, the state attorney general joins us to talk about this Saturday's Drug Take-Back Day. The Wisconsin Department of Justice will hold a Prescription Drug Take-Back Day this Saturday. Law enforcement agencies around the state will have collection sites and boxes so residents can discard unused, old, or unwanted prescriptions.
The DOJ wants to give people a safe and convenient way to dispose of prescription drugs while also educating the public about the potential abuse of these substances.
We're joined now by Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel to discuss the program and other measures the state has taken to fight prescription and illicit drug abuse. Attorney General Schimmel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, before we get into the why of this, can you talk us through the practical side? What's happening on Saturday?
Well, Saturday is the day when we're bringing all of the prescription and over-the-counter medications that are being collected up to 97 different collection points in the state, and then we will put them all, we'll take them all to a central location where we'll load them on trucks and take them to the incinerator. People can go to the DOJ website, the doseofreality.wi.gov, and they can find where the nearest take-back location is for the events these Friday and Saturday. I'd like people to know, though, that they don't have to wait for the twice-a-year drug take-back days. They can go to that website also, enter their zip code, and find the closest medication return unit. And in most cases, you're going to find your local police department or sheriff's department has got a return box that you can take those drugs to any time and get rid of them so you don't leave them in your medicine cabinet.
So this is a year-round collection generally available, but this is a concentrated effort this weekend.
Right. So all the law enforcement agencies that have those medication return units, they're storing the drugs that have been dropped off at their departments in their evidence rooms. So twice a year we clear those out, but also on these days, citizens can bring their prescription and over-the-counter medications that they're no longer using. And I hope people will use this method to get rid of them, either going to the medication return units or the drug take-back day, putting these into flushing them down the toilet or the sink or putting them in the garbage risks these becoming part of our water table, and that's not good for anyone.
How do unused prescription drugs that aren't disposed of at all create a safety concern in homes around the state?
Well, we have found, and you know, for years we've been talking about heroin. We've been very alarmed about the presence of heroin in our state. But the reason heroin is here is because there's a demand for it. And we have found that 70% of the individuals who are addicted to heroin in our state started by becoming addicted to prescription painkillers first. So if we can address the safe storage, the safe taking, and the safe disposal of prescription medications, we can maybe not have to talk about heroin anymore. We also know that 70% of the, and it's a common number that we found here, but 70% of the people who are abusing prescription medications got them improperly from a family member or a friend. They either were given to them or they stole them from them. So if we can have people get the message to safely lock up your prescription medications, we can reduce the diversion of those into abuse.
Now, this is partly, in addition to the collection, this is an awareness issue, it sounds like. I mean, because I've had old prescription medications after surgery or something, and I thought, oh, no harm done. It's just sitting there. You're wanting people not to think that way.
Well, absolutely. You know, none of us would leave a loaded handgun sitting on the kitchen counter with teenagers coming in and out of the house all day. But prescription medications that we don't really think twice about those being in our medicine cabinets, kill far more people in Wisconsin than handguns. As a matter of fact, they now kill more opiates. Heroin and the prescription Medicaid opiates combined are now killing more people than all motor vehicle crashes.
We're talking to Attorney General Brad Schimmel, talking about a drug take-back program happening this weekend around the state. We've got a link to information on the Central Time Facebook page, a link where you can go, enter your zip code, find out where to bring drugs this weekend. And as the Attorney General mentioned, you can, in many places, do this year-round as well. Attorney General Schimmel, I was surprised the first time I've heard it, but I've heard it again and again now, people starting on prescription drugs and then moving to heroin. How big a problem now has this gotten to be in the state?
Well, as a drug overdose is now more likely to kill you than a car crash, as I just said. Mm-hmm. It's more causing more deaths than breast cancer, than colon cancer, than HIV, than influenza, and then more than handguns. The problem is that people believe, mistakenly, that just because it's prescribed by a doctor, it must be safe and it can't be addictive. There's a reason why these have to be prescribed by a doctor and why you have to see a pharmacist to get them, because they do have the potential to be dangerous. And we need to have people ask more questions about what am I going home with? If you get a prescription for Vicodin, you should be, as a parent or as an adult patient, you should be asking, why am I getting these? What do they do? Should I be taking all of them? Is there a point that I can switch to something less harmful? Because prescription opiates are made from the same thing that heroin's made from. And we're working hard through the Dose of Reality campaign to break these myths with the Dose of Reality.
And in that Dose of Reality campaign, are you also reaching out to the healthcare providers themselves to try to make sure their patients are getting these messages?
Yes, and I've got two presentations today to the medical community, one to the Dental Association Board of Governors, and tonight to the Psychiatry Association. They have been partners with us as we've developed these messages. They've helped us to identify things that will be effective to help their members have better communications with their patients. One of the things that the medical community can do is go to our website and download print-ready materials that they can share with their patients, and we hope that they're all going to do that so that when you go home with a prescription for, say, Vicodin or OxyContin, that you'll have a very brief information sheet that gives you some of these alarming facts about that drug. And this isn't about demonizing the prescription or the people who write them or take them. There are legitimate medical reasons that people get these medications. This is about the abuse. Remember, I said 70% of the people that are abusing these prescriptions are getting them from friends and family. If we can reduce that kind of abuse, if we can get people to store them safely, use them only as prescribed to them, and dispose of them properly when they're done, we can lick this problem.
A lot of times when we think about drug addiction, legal or prescription drugs, we think of it as a law enforcement issue or maybe a treatment and rehabilitation issue. It sounds like you're really trying to put a lot more focus on the prevention angle. Why is that important? Why is that a benefit to the state?
Well, we first approached this a little over a decade ago when we started finding heroin in our Wisconsin communities. We first approached it as a law enforcement issue. We were going to arrest our way out of it. The problem is, though, is the scope of it is so large that this isn't just a public safety crisis. This is a public health crisis. And you have to couple the enforcement actions, and we're still doing them. We're ramping up our efforts to stop the flow of heroin into our state, to stop the improper diversion of prescription medications. We're ramping those up, but that's not going to do it alone. Numbers came out last year that estimated that in Wisconsin there are over 163,000 people who abuse opiates in some manner. That means we've got a big problem for our treatment community, which is the second big component in this. But the treatment community is the small end of the funnel. They can only treat so many people, and the big end of the funnel keeps having more and more people coming in. If we're going to beat this, we've got to have effective and pervasive prevention measures to make sure no new people come into this addiction.
I think in the past when people thought drug addiction, they thought maybe stereotypically this is an urban problem, this is a big city problem. How you mentioned the numbers earlier, but how widespread geographically is the problem with opiate prescription drugs and heroin here in the state?
It's affecting every kind of community in our state, and we're at the point now where we're out of our 72 counties, more than 53 of them now are submitting heroin to the state crime lab for testing in criminal cases. It is affecting us all. It's affecting every kind of young person, and it's also affecting older people, middle-aged, and even seniors. This addiction can grab anyone, and we need to be very careful when we take these. We need to be taking them only as prescribed and in consultation with our medical provider.
And are you hearing from law enforcement agencies around the state saying, hey, we're having this, this is new to us, how do we deal with it? Are they turning to you as the Attorney General and the Department of Justice?
Yes, and we've been working hard to train law enforcement. We actually just had a statewide opiate summit Tuesday and Wednesday this week, and we're training law enforcement in how to do effective investigations. We're training law enforcement in the use of Narcan. It's the antidote to an opiate overdose. We're doing all these things, but we still need to get these people help. We've found that we can lock them up even for a year and a half in the prison, and they come out and nothing's changed about them, because you need to have effective treatment, and you need to have that treatment working in the real world so that they can test it and they can learn how to have the tools to stay sober. We've got a big job in front of us, and people can't afford to believe the myth that this can't happen to them, that this can't happen in their neighborhood or their school district, because it's happening in every school district in our state. We've got to get out in front of this, and we've got to stop pretending that this is just the bad kids that this happens to. I have met hundreds of parents who have buried their children because of opiate overdoses, and I've yet to meet the parent who thought their child was the bad kid. We have got to wake up to this dose of reality.
Attorney General Schimmel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel talking about the state's Prescription Drug Take-Back Day happening this Saturday around Wisconsin. We've got a link with info about where you can drop off your old prescription medications. It's on the Central Time Facebook page.
According to a recent survey commissioned by the Association of American Universities, 1 in 4 women experience sexual assault on college campuses. Our next guest was the 1 in 4. On her second night away at college, she was raped by a fellow student. The university determined that there was no conclusive evidence she'd been raped, and in a matter of months allowed her rapist to move into the same dormitory where she lived.
To find her own power and strength and prove that she could take care of herself, she decided to drop out of school and hike the Pacific Crest Trail, which begins in Mexico and ends in Canada.
She tells the story of that journey and what it meant to her as a rape survivor in the book Girl in the Woods. Aspen Mattis joins us now. Aspen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before you went on your kind of epic hike along the Pacific Crest Trail, you talked to your parents, and your dad, at one point he says to you something like, what do you think is going to happen? Sort of, what do you want to come out of this? And one of the things you said was that you wanted to feel powerful. Why did you think that hiking the Pacific Crest Trail would do that for you?
Well, I think there were a few reasons. One was that I'd always really felt like I wasn't capable of taking good care of myself in, like, the world and feeling safe in the world, in the body that I had to live in, like getting to places on time, having my word be heard and audible and respected. And I think the rape really, really, in my vision, confirmed that. I thought it was sort of, in my 18-year-old mind, it was sort of confirmation that I had poor judgment and that, how could I have trusted a rapist, and I wasn't capable of functioning on my own in the world. And I saw the trail as a place where I would be forced to rise to the occasion. I would have to prove again and again that I was capable of taking care of myself and prove that to myself if I was going to survive. So it was like, if I could survive there, if I could take good care of myself in the desert, in the Mojave Desert, in the High Sierra, in, like, the Cascade Mountains alone, then I could take care of myself and be okay anywhere.
And you wanted to hike because you had been raped your second night at college. This was at Colorado College. You were from the East Coast. It was a new town in many, many senses. And this changed everything for you. What happened?
Yeah. On my second night of my freshman year at college, before classes had begun, before I had, like, removed my colorful construction paper name tag from my dorm room door, I was raped by another freshman. And I reported the rape to the college, and I went through. The college encouraged me not to. They told me that if I reported the rape to the police, I'd waited too long. I'd waited 2 weeks, and it was too late to conduct a rape kit, so I would have no evidence, so nothing would really come of it. So I went to the school's rape response coordinator, and I remember at the time it totally blew my mind that a tiny little campus of 2,000 kids would even need a rape response coordinator as a full-time position. Like, I didn't think that rape could possibly be common.
And what kind
in
of
retrospect, I know now that it's incredibly common.
What kind of response did you get there from the rape counselor?
Well, so she was, like, I think, a very kind woman in a profoundly dysfunctional, broken system that doesn't want justice. It actually, I think colleges have brands, and they put a lot of money into the creation and protection of their brands, and the last thing that a college wants is a rape conviction on campus, and so it's therefore not in the best interest of the college to have the truth come out. And so there's a system in place. They encouraged me to go through the school's conflict mediation process as if rape could be mediated, like a playground fight. and they really treated it like something we had both done wrong. And I testified, and he testified, and the mediator concluded that the findings were inconclusive, and which is essentially effectively, they concluded that he was innocent, which meant that I was guilty of lying. And then they allowed him to remain on campus.
We're talking with Aspen Mattis right now. She's the author of Girl in the Woods. It's a memoir of her 2,000-mile trek along the Pacific Crest Trail in the aftermath of a rape. And Aspen, you said initially that one of the things you wanted on the trail, you wanted to feel powerful. And here you are on this trail, you're hiking thousands of miles, and you're there are a lot of men on the trail. The ratio of men to women is something like 5 to 1. You're in threatening situations from nature and from other people at some points. Did you have that feeling of power that you were looking for? Did you find it?
Yeah, in waves and in moments. The trail really tested me and forced me to find my power. It kind of left me with no option other than to rise to the occasion. Like, as you said, that's such a tremendous observation. There were so many more men on this trail than women, so I'd really fled this, like, kind of world of college where there's, like, one girl to every guy and in very close quarters, into the woods and into the desert, a girl among men. And, like, they say instead of beer goggles, it's trail goggles. And so I was constantly put in the position of making my boundaries clear and saying no, really, like, no, I'm not interested when something felt wrong for me, and saying no without apology. And again and again and again, I found that my voice was audible, that people respected it, that if I said I didn't want to do something, people would not try to make me do that thing. And that was so empowering. Like, confronting your fears is so empowering, especially when, in this case, like, it's just a very specific sort of form of immersion therapy. Like, I'm not only doing, or not doing, but it's confronting the thing that bit me, the thing that scared me and hurt me, and that, you know, that left me feeling powerless. And I'm conquering it again and again and again on a daily basis. I'm finding water for myself. I'm navigating. I'm pitching my tent every night and putting sunscreen on my face every morning and staying hydrated and hiking like 26 miles on average every day, like a literal marathon a day, every day with a backpack on, and proving my strength and proving my strength and proving my strength to myself until it was undeniable to myself and I'd really earned my own respect.
In terms of recovering from the rape itself, I don't know if you ever completely recover or if it's just something you carry with you. It's probably individual for all people, but was there a moment when you felt freed of it?
I think there was a moment when it became smaller, and that was the moment when, it wasn't actually a moment, it was like a series of moments when in strength, when I was feeling so strong in myself, and someone would ask me the most common question on the trail among thru-hikers, among the people who are walking the whole trail, this whole way from Mexico all the way to Canada, the most common question was, why are you doing this? Like, what's your reason? Because we all had reasons, and sometimes it wasn't that overt, but people would try to feel it out. They would want to know if you had just lost your job, or if you were trying to quit an addiction, or if you had just been dumped, you know, because I don't think anyone decides to be homeless for 5.5 to 6 months and sleep in a tent in the dirt and deprive themselves of watermelon and plumbing if they're super happy with their lives in the real world. And so in the moments when I felt kind of, as you call it, not healed, but strong again and sort of and less in the shadow of my rape and less, like, cramped by it, were the moments when I had already sort of earned my respect for myself by taking good care, and then someone would ask me why I was walking, what my reason was, and I would tell them the truth. And I think calling a rape, calling a spade, makes it something outside of you. Like, the rape is the terrible, disgusting, horrible, dirty thing, not me. And it kind of shrinks it. It puts it in its place. It's not, I shouldn't feel ashamed, not shame on me, shame on him. And it really, telling the truth always clarifies things, whether it be in writing or to a friend, laying down the facts. It didn't allow me to fester in this confusion of my mind when I was in silence, because I knew I felt like disgusting and ashamed, and I felt those emotions couldn't possibly be anything guilty, and I thought they couldn't be invalid because I felt them so intensely, but that's actually wrong. They were valid. They were the product of a flawed story I was telling myself, and telling the truth about what had happened to me, and speaking openly and freely and honestly about my second night at college made it just one night. I didn't have to carry it like a secret, because secrets become lies, and lies consume us, and speaking something makes it so much less less consuming. You literally let it out.
Well, Aspen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Aspen Mattis is at work on a novel. Her new memoir is called Girl in the Woods. She's donating 5% of her book proceeds to the group RAIN, Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. The group's 24-hour hotline helped her after her rape in 2008.
We just heard the story of rape survivor Aspen Mattis, who hiked the Pacific Crest Trail in the aftermath of her sexual assault. The hike, she says, helped her with personal empowerment and recovery.
Jamie Sathasivam is the program director of the Rape Crisis Center in Madison, and she joins us now to talk about that recovery process and what it can be like. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So we're hearing statistics gathered from college campuses about how 1 in 4 women experience sexual assault on college campuses, and rape, of course, a reality in the non-college world, too. What do you want survivors to know about what that healing process can be like afterwards?
Sure. So the healing process is so individual. Some people, it's really about taking back that power and control. And for Aspen, it sounds like that was really something that resonated with her. She needed to go out, take control of her life, be able to empower herself and do what felt right for her instead of sort of sticking through school. And that's to be credited. For some people, it's receiving counseling. Some want to report to law enforcement, some don't. And all of that is fine. It's about empowering the survivor to take control back in their own life. And that's what we do at RCC. We very much advocate for survivors to choose their healing path.
And obviously, hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, I think it took her 5 or 6 months, and not everyone can take 5 or 6 months just to mentally process things. I mean, how do you suggest, or how have you seen people use the time afterwards and how they think about it and how they process?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, again, it's very much dependent on which avenue they decide to pursue. If they decide to pursue the legal process, that can drag out the healing process for quite a long time as they work through all of the legal reports and making its way through the criminal justice system. And for some people, that means that they're going to be sort of stuck in their healing for a while. Some people, it's about doing that so that they can regain control and say that this was not right and I didn't do anything wrong and I need to stand up for myself. So the healing process is so individualized. The length of time is so individualized, but really it's about allowing that survivor to be empowered in whatever choices they make and validating that nothing they did caused this to happen. Doesn't matter what you drink, how much you drink. Having a sexual assault, experiencing a sexual assault is not a natural consequence of drinking. It's not a consequence of wearing a short skirt. And we have to stop associating those two things because it's very damaging to victims.
And how common is that sort of thinking after a sexual assault that, you know, there is some blame mm-hmm. for the victim there. Is that the kind of thing that you see typically?
Absolutely. I mean, I think ask any survivor why they didn't want to come forward and tell their family. They've got those messages in their head already. They're aware of what people are going to think and what people are going to say. They're going to ask those questions, particularly when we're talking about college students. Parents are going to want to know, were you out drinking? Friends are going to want to know, what were you wearing? Why did you go home with that person? Why did you allow them to come back to your dorm? So those messages that I think sort of in our own minds allow us to feel as though, especially as women, that we're safe, also sort of counteract the healing process for survivors because they know that those are the judgments that people are placing on them very unfairly.
So what is the antidote to that for someone? You know, for Aspen, it was this long journey on a trail and just a gradual mental awareness that it was only rapists cause rape, is I think how she writes it in the book. But how do other people get there?
I think there are so many ways. I think starting to have a larger cultural conversation around what is rape culture, what is misogyny, what causes sexual assault, and that's the rapist, right? It's not the alcohol. It's not the whatever the victim is wearing. It's not that they were alone walking at night. It's about the rapist. And how do we empower women to stand together instead of disempowering people so that we divide and conquer and allow sexual assault to be as common as it is? Because I think the statistics of 1 in 4 women before age 18 and 1 in 6 boys before 18 is just horrific. And I don't understand how that number can stand. And we don't have conversations daily as a nation about how to stop that.
We're talking right now with Jamie Sathasitham. She is a program director at the Rape Crisis Center in Madison. And we're talking right now about recovery after sexual assault. If you have a story to share or advice to share, you can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And in terms of resources, techniques that may help, what advice would you want to give someone who's listening right now, who's just been through something like this, a sexual assault? What sorts of tools could help?
I would say, I know that it's really hard, but we have a 24-hour helpline. It's available 24/7, 365 days a year, staffed by professionals who are well-trained to be able to support you and start to counteract some of those messages that you may have floating around in your own mind that other people may be giving you. It's available to survivors and support people so that you can learn how to support someone who's just experienced a really devastating, potentially, assault. And so call that number. It's 251-7273, local in Dane County, and find out about the resources, find out about what the options are for your next steps, and then be empowered to take those choices and take those next steps, whatever that may be for you.
So it sounds like it's a very, very individual process, and people may want to know, you know, how long is this going to take? When will I feel better? Yeah. And I'm guessing there is no one answer.
No, I wish I had a magic pill. I wish I had a magic answer to say, well, wait 5 months and you're going to be healed. For some people, it's, you know, weeks. And for some people, it might be years. It's really an individualized journey, and respecting that everyone needs to take the time and space to create that journey is critical.
And if you're a friend or a family member of someone dealing with the aftermath of a sexual assault, what kinds of things do you want them to know about how to be supportive, to offer support?
Yeah, I think the best thing that you can say as a friend or a family member supporting someone else is, thank you for sharing. It's not your fault. I so appreciate that you told me this, and how can I help you? Give them the choice and what the next steps are. I think especially for parents, it's really easy to get wrapped up in wanting to create justice or to have some follow through for the perpetrator. But really talk to that victim and find out what they want. And I use the word victim and survivor sort of interchangeably. Victim is a legal term. Survivor is what we use frequently at the office. But so please don't take offense to the word victim. It's really about saying, thank you for sharing. I'm here with you. There's nothing you did to deserve this. And I'm so sorry that happened to you.
And we've been talking about, you're just speaking about terminology. We've been using the word healed. I mean, and I've been curious as I talk to Aspen and now to you, is this the sort of thing that you, most survivors feel that there's a point at which becomes past tense and you are healed, or is it same sort of thing as with death where you sort of carry it with you the rest of your life, or is it just both?
I mean, I think it could be both. It depends on the person. What we hear so often from people is that they do heal. It takes time, but that they do heal. And I think for when I go and I tell people what my job is, I'm always hesitant because you get the, ooh, you do that for a living? And there's sort of that like cringe moment. It's like, no, it's hard at times. It's really hard. But for the most part, we get to see survivors move through the process and move back to feeling as though they can take control and be empowered to make this one piece of their life and not their entire life.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today and talking.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking to Jamie Sathasivam. She's program director at the Right Rape Crisis Center in Madison. We've been talking about recovery from sexual assault.